You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, again, once again, we're about to start an incredible episode of The Brian Callen / Hunter Motz Show. And just said goodbye to my really lovely family. My loud... Hunter's dying.
I'm dying. Because that's what happens when your family leaves. I have withdrawal.
Your children are a good microcosm for what's right and mostly what's wrong with the world. human nature is interesting that way, where it's like they have their own autonomy. They want their own autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
They are self-centered, and they want it now.
Yeah,
and everything else comes second. As an adult, you start to learn not to do that. You kind of start learning how to lie to yourself and others about the fact that other people matter more. It's such a lie. You know, we are not like, I was listening to Gad Saad. We were talking about him on Joe Rogan, Smart Guy. And, he was essentially saying this: the laughable thing is when governments and politicians decide we got to make people healthier, so let's get the information out there. Let's get some public service announcements about how fats are bad.
Yeah.
Trans fats are bad and smoking's bad for you. People know that smoking is bad for them. They know, they're very aware that what they're doing is probably not good for them, and they're also aware they could make a healthier choice. Has nothing to do with that kind of rational mindset.
Nope.
It's a thousand other things that it's impulses. It's they derive pleasure from that destructive behavior for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's a ton of them, but it's an important thing to keep in mind.
Well, and also it's often about social life, right? So
yeah, I like drinking, and I'm sure people like smoking when they're being social.
Well, because if you remember in The Power of Habit, one of the things that Charles Duhigg talks about is the fact that every afternoon he would go for an afternoon cookie.
Yeah.
And the point was not the cookie. The point was going and talking to people for 10, 15 minutes, having some sort of like conversational break.
I do it all. I don't like beer. I don't drink. I like expensive wine.
Yeah.
And that's it. And you don't usually have expensive as shit Bordeaux's in the bars that I frequent when I'm on the road, but I have two beers because it's a social thing to do.
Of course.
And I want something in my hand.
And
I don't even like beer.
If you don't drink, then you start to become antisocial, right? You
yes.
don't get that bonding. It's not the same thing. People are sort of a little more on edge. They wonder why you're not drinking and all that sort of
stuff. Yeah, and people are like, come on, dude, you don't want to drink. And it's always like, well.
So what you, that's the point, is what you want is you want that tribal connection.
Mm.
So, and you would like to be part of a truly great tribe that shares your values and beliefs and always have really good Bordeaux's available. And that's why
I also want to be part of a macho tribe.
Yeah. Well, that's the point. A tribe that has responsibility, strength, takes care of things, all of that, and that is the Callen fate.
And a sexual tribe, too. I want a bunch of loose morals. I want a bunch of people around me who are willing to share their women.
Oh, really?
I mean, you know, honestly?
Yeah,
sure.
Honestly.
Honestly, sure, I'm probably a swinger at heart. I mean, am I a pervert? Yes. The answer would be 100% yes. I think people are very uptight about sex, but maybe that's just I'm getting older and I'm noticing that women are not as attracted to me anymore.
No, Brian, that's not true.
I mean, I used to be a real piece of meat, ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you. I mean, in my 20s and 30s, I was just desirable as all get out.
Yeah, but when you're powerful enough, you know, then it doesn't matter how wrinkly or saggy you are. I mean, look at Vladimir Putin. He rides around in his, I mean, you know.
Yeah, but I'm not. And no. Also, I am 49 with a wife and two kids. That's not typically what young, hot dames are looking for in a guy.
But if you really wanted to become a dictator, Brian, like if you...
I'd be miserable. I'd be a terrible dictator, though.
Why would you be a terrible dictator?
Because I would, first of all, probably have strong ideas of what needed to be fixed.
Right.
And in my opinion, it's not a long list,
mm-hmm.
but I might get talked into a long list.
But see, you're saying this essentially in your cool state, when you don't have that kind of power.
Yeah.
Right? Power, you know, messes with people's psychology. Absolute power corrupts.
Yeah.
Right? Absolutely. So the question is that, you know, how do you think, there's who Putin was in 2000 or 99, right? And there's who Putin is now, right?
No, I have a less of an impulse for power. My drive would probably be to have everybody like me.
Yeah.
The power over people was never like a, it's never been, never. I can never remember being turned on by the fact that I could somehow make or break someone's, say, reputation.
Right.
You know, you get to a point as a comic, or even when you're, I've always been popular, right? Mm-hmm. In school and stuff. You, I suppose there are times when, you know, people have done shitty things to me, and I could have exacted some kind of social revenge, mm-hmm. right? But of course, first of all, I don't think that's very manly. I'd rather punch the guy in the face. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I'm too afraid to do that because I don't want to get sued or a thousand other reasons. The impulse would maybe present itself and then go away very quickly. It wasn't something. I'm not vengeful that way. And I think that comes from perspective and the notion that I'm already a speck of sand in a giant universe. What does it matter?
So if we're talking about these two forms of power, dominance and prestige, right? Dominance doesn't interest you, right?
Dominance doesn't. I've never, I don't look at it that way. I don't like you know, comedy-wise. So I think I'm a good comic. You know, mm-hmm. I believe that. I believe I'm really good at stand-up. And so I suppose I'm very secure in that belief. So the idea that I should win some award, or I should be selling out the Beacon Theater 10 times in a row, that'd be nice, but it's not affirmation for my talent. Mm-hmm. It would be nice. That just means more people would be aware of the fact that I can make you laugh really hard for an hour and 15 minutes or whatever. So once people learn that, it wouldn't surprise me that, you know, a lot of people would want to come and have that experience. I have that capability. That's my skill set.
Mm-hmm.
But that the difference between that and someone else is just a set of circumstances that are probably, if they are in my control, I'm probably not very interested in controlling them. You know, I suppose I could be a better marketer. I suppose I could be more strategic. I suppose I'd be harder working in that area. I probably won't.
Right.
And if it does happen, it'll be a happy accident for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll have more money. You know, when people would say that's more power. Well, no, I'd travel differently maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know what I would do with more money. I really don't.
But so in terms of those, you know, Daniel Pink talks about those three drives, right, that are sort of predominate at this point in history, which are autonomy, mastery, and purpose, right?
Yeah.
So those are sort of, it is that.
Those are three great goals. Autonomy, mastery, and purpose are exactly, and they all come hand in hand.
Right.
I mean, when you have mastery of something, and you know, I don't think you ever master comedy because, mm-hmm. I'm trying to write new stuff now and I'm struggling.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, you start from square one. You just learn to trust your impulses more and stuff. But I've certainly mastered to an extent. The art form, insofar as it can earn me a very good living,
mm-hmm.
and insofar as also I'm satisfied with what I'm doing, I'm proud of what I'm doing. So in that sense, but then autonomy comes with your own wealth. I might mm-hmm. be able to make money off my imagination, thank God. And then purpose is kind of goes with autonomy and mastery, because purpose, the idea behind for me for purpose is fulfilling my potential. I realized what my potential was as a young man, and now I think I'm fulfilling it.
Right.
So great goals. I like the way those are put. I'm going to steal that.
Well, and that's worth talking about as well. So,
who said this?
So this is Daniel Pink, and it's from a book called Drive, and he has this great sort of schema, this great way of sort of understanding human history, right? So a great lens. And the lens is that there have essentially been three different versions of motivation, right? So there's motivation 1.0, and motivation 1.0 is fear-based. So that's Hobbes's Leviathan, everybody obeys the law because otherwise the king kills them and all that sort of stuff, right? There's motivation 2.0, which is capitalism, which is all based on, you know, getting ahead, you know, doing things for yourself. It's extrinsic motivation. You do things for some sort of financial reward.
Comforts.
All of that sort of stuff. Yeah. And in fact, though, people who are intrinsically motivated, who are motivated by a desire for autonomy, mastery, and purpose, are more successful than people who are just motivated by cash. That's what all the research shows.
Well, certainly
the
more fulfilled. I mean, I think cash, and you know, I'm a capitalist, but you know, the motivation 2.0, whatever it is all about fulfilling sensations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a better view, better sex, better food, a nicer car, a cleaner,
mm-hmm.
more comfortable smelling, feeling environment, fine clothing. It really is all sort of a massage for your senses.
Well, and also a lot of it is about what other people think, right?
100%. Yes, but of course, you know, you don't have to be a historian to know that that isn't enough.
It isn't, no. And no. even by the way, Adam Smith is very clear that that's not what makes people happy in the end. Mm. In The Theory of Moral Sentiments, he talks endlessly about the fact that, you know, although we're attracted to fame and all of that sort of stuff, it's not actually what makes people happy ultimately. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's, again, what all the research bears out. Past a certain level, extra financial wealth doesn't make you any happier. Right?
100%. A third Tesla.
Yeah.
You know,
is not going to make.
I had this
happier.
House, you know, this wonderful house, and I think anything bigger in a better location wouldn't do a damn thing.
Nope.
In fact, the reason I want more space is so I can have more friends over, mm-hmm. and be the apex.
Yeah.
Be the host of you know what we were talking about, my salons.
Your salon.
My salons, where we debate politics and philosophy, have conversations this way. And I would be the MC, the master of ceremonies, and perhaps even some music.
And only the finest Bordeaux would be served.
Naturally. Naturally.
The premier cru.
Ouais, ouais. Le grand cru classique. Yeah.
So that's the thing, is that now what the world is moving into, increasingly more and more people are moving towards autonomy, mastery, and purpose in order to provide them with a more satisfying life in one way or the other. And we're all sort of, you know, that's where the culture is evolving towards. But then the
question. I hope so.
Well, that's what the impulse and the drive are, but there are always, you know, there's always a tension between unity and disunity. So, you know, the opening line of one of the great four Chinese novels, The Romance of the Three Kingdoms, is that it is a truth that has long been accepted, that everything that has long been united must be divided, and everything that has long been divided must be united. Mm. And that is the nature of Chinese history. You have, you know, the empire is unified, and then it splits into warring kingdoms, and then eventually, after a long enough period of these warring kingdoms, it's unified into a grand empire and it splits. So it's this constant cycle of breaking apart and unifying, breaking apart and unifying. And that's part of what I wanted to talk about today.
Good. Please, if you listen to this, I want you to tweet Joe Rogan. Tell him to get Hunter Motz on the podcast. Because Hunter needs to be on Joe Rogan's podcast. He'll be a star. Okay, and I'm going to do that. I know I keep saying that, and I keep texting Joe, and I'm going to do it again. God damn it. Anyway, okay. Now, let's talk about what we're going to talk about.
So, one of the pieces of feedback that we got from the last podcast was that some people felt that I was being unfair to Brexit. And, you know, I think what came out of those conversations, which is very interesting, is that there's, you know, there's obviously within the people who wanted to leave the EU, there's a spectrum. There are a lot of people who just were sort of motivated by, you know, the little England petty nationalist idea of, like, you know, I mean, if you had a lot of British people on your Facebook feed, which I did, there were a lot of photos of bulldogs being thrown around and, like, sausage rolls.
Yeah.
And, like, these were essentially the arguments, you know.
Yeah.
It was their version of because America.
Yeah.
Right? So. Yeah. That was.
It was also about immigration, I think, too, right?
Well,
the idea that they were losing.
Yeah, and there were more sensitive and more thoughtful arguments, and those are the kind of people who listen to the Brian Callen Show, and those are the kind of people who reached out to me.
God bless you all.
God bless you all. And so, you know, the arguments were essentially that, yes, there's the issue of immigration. There's also the classic thing is there's a big difference culturally between the UK and the continent in terms of their feelings about bureaucracy. So the French and the Germans, they love bureaucracy, and you can never have enough bureaucracy and regulation. And the EU passed, I remember when I was in the UK.
But yeah, in all fairness to the Germans, they are the best bureaucrats in the world.
Oh, absolutely. Angela Merkel is, you know.
I mean, they are very good at getting shit done. It's like a...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But some of that bureaucracy, I mean, some of that bureaucracy can become unnecessary and counterproductive.
Yeah.
And certainly it rubs the Brits the wrong way, just as it rubs Americans the wrong way, because the Brits and the Americans are culturally very similar.
Yeah.
So, for example, you know, when I was in the UK, you know, they had all of these regulations they were passing, and some of them were sort of reasonable, like to be called Champagne, you have to come from the Champagne region. Mm-hmm. And some of them were not reasonable in terms of what could be called chocolate. And so Cadbury's, which is the British chocolate, and, you know,
fantastic chocolate,
which is incredibly good.
Fucking fantastic. And I love Britain, but keep going.
Yeah, the Cadbury's caramel, that was my candy of choice when I lived there.
Jesus.
And but the point is that it doesn't satisfy sort of the Belgian definition of chocolate, because they use, you know, whatever animal
too
fats
much vanilla
or whatever the hell else it is, right?
Yeah.
And so they wanted to make it so that Cadbury's chocolate was not legally allowed to call itself chocolate.
That's amazing.
And it would have to be called Cadbury's chocolate product, or like chocolate, you
that's
know,
amazing.
Simulacra or
how
whatever.
Dare,
yeah,
how
exactly.
How dare they?
Or the other famous one was the EU supposedly tried to regulate the curvature of a banana,
yep.
right?
Yep.
You know, so there were all these ridiculous bureaucratic things, and that is a legitimate cultural difference between the Brits and the continental Europeans. And, you know, yes, bureaucracy is not necessarily helpful. It doesn't necessarily make for enterprise, and it's understandable that there are people who objected to that. And there's, of course, the issue of immigration, which was a legitimate issue as well. So there are certain legitimate arguments, but the point that I was trying to make on the last podcast is that what I personally want, right, it comes out of a recognition that, you know, wealth, right, large scale wealth, right, a prosperous society, that I am better off creating a society where other people can compete, even if it comes at my personal expense.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of having free trade, and, you know, there's the possibility.
I feel exactly the same way.
Yeah.
And I just to, for a second to pause on that. I feel that way because, for example, we've talked about this before, but as an actor, when the Brits and the Australians and the Scots, you know, et al., and the New Zealanders came in and started learning American accents and taking American jobs as
mm-hmm.
actors, you know, there are a lot of people like, I can't believe this. Listen, man, those guys are just better.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm down to compete with the world.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not ever going to say those guys shouldn't be allowed to compete. Are you out of your mind?
Yep.
If the best man gets the job, and I've
mm-hmm.
lost way more than I've gained, but I would never change that because
exactly.
it's called a meritocracy. Anything else would be a lie and artificial.
It's a lie and it's artificial. It leads to a falling of quality. Right?
Yeah.
And fundamentally, you know, you end up hurting yourself. I mean, the big example I always think is Henry VIII. So Henry VIII, you know, actually as a young man was an incredible athlete. You know, he was like a real stud. He was skinny. He did all these different sports. And, you know, during a jousting accident, which is, you know, wonderfully captured in the Tudors, he gets whacked in the leg and his leg shatters.
Wow.
And because he was in the 1500s, they did not have the technology to fix his leg. So here's a man who has all the wealth in England. And he dissolved the monasteries, and he's rich as can be. But for the rest of his life, he was essentially a gimp.
I didn't know that.
Because he couldn't really move around, and because he consumed like 5,000 calories a day, you know, he became morbidly obese. And that wound stank. It smelled terrible. So, you know, you imagine these poor women. It's not only that they were getting executed, his wives. It's also
God.
That, you know, he was fat. He had this big wound in his leg, and for the rest of his life, his physicians would pull splinters out of his leg, and it stank to high heaven.
Damn.
So, but would you rather be Henry VIII, or would you rather be Brian Callen?
Brian Callen.
100%. For a million reasons, because...
My jawline, I'm
yeah,
shredded.
And you would be able to fix your own
I don't
leg.
Have any wounds near
no.
my groin. So when I gift women my piece, I don't have to worry about a smelling gangrenous wound. I got good news and better news. The good news is this is my dick. The better news is I don't have a gangrenous Henry VIII hip sore. So you're welcome.
You're welcome.
As my wife rolls her eyes.
But the point is that, you know, even, you know, to be a lot of these dictators, right, the point is that you're far better off creating a system that, you know, enables everyone to be creative and everyone to be, you know, competing, and that is meritocratic, because it ultimately creates a world far better than a world in which you're extractive and, you know, try and gather all the wealth
sure.
in your hands, right?
Sure.
Or, for example, great example example that you gave in terms of the actors, where you erect barriers to competition or barriers to labor so that, you know, you have a protectionist market. And
by
you
the way,
be
I sympathize, however, with people who have had generations of a way of life.
Totally.
And for a thousand reasons, another country that practices, you know, probably currency manipulation and stuff and all that makes it much, much cheaper to buy from that country. I can understand the emotion, the human desperation and emotional impulse to stage strikes, to pressure your government, to petition your government to somehow impose tariffs and make their product more expensive.
100%.
And, you know, in a way, you can say, look, this will make our economy better to an extent. It might be a little bit more expensive for my butter, but don't you want British butter? You know, seven of my family, generations family, have been making great butter, and these other people are coming along and pushing me out of the market. Where am I going to go? I get that. I think I'd probably certainly... I've never been in that position. That's a very scary position to be in.
100%.
If my kids couldn't eat or they had no other alternatives, I'd be out in the street myself. So.
And that's the point, is that what we need is we need a system that allows us to progress and innovate and have the benefits of all the creativity and hard work of the world, right? And all of that great culture clash, all those ideas having sex. But at the same time, it makes sure that people have the capacity and the resources to be able to adapt, you know, to deal with the fact that the world is now changing so quickly that a lot of us for our jobs is, you know, our industries will disappear and we will have to suddenly retrain and learn a bunch of skills. And the question is, each culture and each society is going to come up with different mechanisms for dealing with that. Scandinavians will doubtless have much more sort of job training and much more sort of government support, and that fits with the culture, which is a much more communitarian culture. Americans will not necessarily, right? Because
Europeans have always had to adapt involuntarily for the most part.
Humans have always had to adapt.
Yeah.
And so, but that's the challenge that we face, is how to figure out a system that, you know, a system has legitimacy when it is a good social contract for everyone.
Well, we were talking about,
at least a large enough constituency.
In the life and death of the great American city, what's her name? Jill something or other who wrote it.
JJ. What's her name? Jane Jacobson.
Jane Jacobson says there is a cataclysmic influx of money when money comes in too quickly, like it has, in my opinion, in Venice, California, from Google and this stuff. Boy, oh boy, can it be cataclysmic, because rents go so high that the fabric of the town, of this walking village that I've spent so much of my time in, that I really consider my real home. I never had a home, you know. I just never have. But to have lived somewhere for 17 years the way I did in Venice, it's very, very much my home. And I think to see now that there is, and this is not an exaggeration, on Abbot Kinney there is a Swedish sinus store. It's called the Swedish sinus store. The Swedish sinus store. Apparently Swedes know more about your fucking sinuses, and they have a store. And I can't wait to go in and see what the fuck
dedicated
to your sinus is. But if you want to talk about this is what happens when, you know, there's just either too much money or, you know, every other store now is a corporate chain, and it's becoming Soho on the beach. And people that used to live here can't afford to live here. Stores that were here, this gay bar, the Rooster Fish, that was here since the 70s, they jacked their rent up to $40,000. And they're gone. The Rooster Fish, which was the only gay bar in Venice, which was so much more than a gay bar. It was just like a hub for community, for a real community in Venice, mostly gay men, and women. But it was just so much more than that. It was a landmark, and when you look at it, you felt good as a resident, because you thought, there's one of those constants. Howl's Bar and Grill. There were these places that played jazz on a Monday. They couldn't afford to live there. And now you have the Swedish sinus store. and Vince, you know, anyway, it just gets, it's in every other coffee shop there is. And I was saying to you that if consumerism, you know, becomes your God, and this is not a new idea, but sometimes I feel like all that money can really turn a group of people into silly, caffeinated, vain wretches.
Wow, Brian.
Wretch.
That
I couldn't think
strong.
Of a better word. So
no, but it's but the way you said it, there was so much. There was ennui. There was a certain amount of contempt.
I like ennui. I like that word, which I had used earlier today. But I think what happens is you know, it's a little bit like the catastrophe of success with Tennessee Williams when he became famous and he stopped being able to tell the difference between chocolate syrup and gravy. He lost the ability to, his senses were so indulged that he started losing the ability to tell the difference. And being able to taste the difference is probably the most important thing in life. I'm not just talking about taste with your mouth, but being able to see, feel, and know and taste the difference, the meaningful difference between things. That's where you know the difference between real effort, artisanship.
That's what intelligence is. That's the etymology of intelligence.
And cultivation.
Yeah, intelligence means to choose between, interlegere. To choose between.
Intelegere.
Yeah.
To choose between.
Yeah.
It's going to be my dropping knowledge on the fighter and the kid.
Mm-hmm.
To choose between.
Right? It's the wisdom to know the difference, right? So it's also the serenity prayer, right? Yes. God grant me the strength to change the things that I can, the courage to accept the things that I can't, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Yes.
It all comes in the wisdom to know the difference, and that's what, you know, your attention allows you to do, is to pick these things apart.
Yes,
right?
But so much of what we live in is, you know, I mean, I was in New York, and I was watching Adele's band, these backup singers, sing. Mm-hmm. If you're a backup singer to Adele, wow. And then on other nights, this guy, Noam, who owns the place, he inherited from his father, and he has political debates. Mm-hmm. He's a conservative, but a social liberal. Mm-hmm. One of his waitstaff is a man who was like, look, I want to dress as a woman, but you're a conservative. And he goes, I'm conservative. I don't dress any way you want. Just take care of my customers. I'm not a conservative in that sense of the word. I'm a conservative in other ways. But when you go there and you hear these people playing music that really means something, and then this guy takes political debate very seriously, and then I come back to LA and people are posting pictures of their shoes and cars on Instagram, it's a little difficult. And because the problem with that is that you don't know the difference when you do that. You don't know why that is not only empty, but might very well be destructive.
Yeah, well, and I mean, crucially, the point is you don't know yourself. Because what is the appeal of cars and shoes and all
status.
That sort of stuff? It's status, but it's also fundamentally that, you know, the whole way that we learn anything is we start with the superficial and we work inwards. So it's essentially, it's a false signaling mechanism.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with fashion.
There's nothing wrong with having a passion for cars. I mean, there's artistry in cars.
Of course.
Artistry in fashion, of course, but...
But true happiness is going to come intrinsically from autonomy, mastery, and purpose.
Yes.
And I think the, you know, what Jane Jacobson, I mean, the whole point of
you know
the...
You know that I'm going to tweet that right now.
Oh, but Brian, feel free.
I'm tweeting it right now.
But the whole point of Jane Jacobson's book...
I'm going to put, who is the guy?
That's Daniel Pink. But the point of Jane Jacobson's book is the fact that
true happiness...
I would say so. And I think the concept of motivation 1.0 and motivation 2.0 and motivation 3.0 is very useful in terms of delineating between those different periods in history. Now, in fact, I would argue that there is a motivation, you know, there is a beta version of motivation, or motivation 0.0 or 0.1 if you want, which is tribal life.
Where, oh, that's interesting.
Right? And that's originally because you have these tribes of 150 that would periodically form, you know, tribal groups, but they were motivated by, you know, the sort of communitarian focus on the tribe, the fear of being murdered by other tribes. You know, they were motivated by a fear of starvation, but they were also motivated by a sense of belonging and tribal unity and all that sort of stuff. And so, you know, while Motivation 3.0 is going to be part of our motivation now is about autonomy, mastery, and purpose, that's the individualistic version. Mm. Part of it is that we have a motivation for belonging. That's Sebastian right. Younger's point in Tribe.
Yes.
So Motivation 3.0 is in many senses a return. I mean, I think more and more I realize that when Marshall McLuhan talked about the global village,
yeah.
that he was incredibly prescient, because the society that we're evolving to is incredibly, is a lot like a village.
Very much so. You see such similarities now. If you were to walk through Milan, mm-hmm. you know, my friend was in Italy, and he was like, you know, I prefer New York. It's more Italian. So I credited Daniel Pink from his book Drive. I said, true happiness comes from autonomy, mastery, and purpose. But is that what he said, true happiness?
I don't know. He talks yeah. about that, those three things as being the key to Motivation 3.0. But he doesn't explicitly say true happiness comes from autonomy, mastery, and purpose.
Right.
But I'm glad that we're composing your tweet in the middle of this podcast.
Yeah, I just had to do it.
But so in terms of, you know, that's really what the Callan Fate is about.
Yes.
It's about creating a society where everybody is allowed to spend their time and their energy pursuing autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Mm-hmm. And where everybody has the security to know, in whatever way you structure that financially, that they aren't going to have to worry about fear of death, violent death, and that they're, you know, yes. not going to have to worry about, oh, somebody just, you know, created destruction. Somebody just created some sort of new amazing technology, mm-hmm. which now means that my old way of doing things no longer, there's no demand for it. So the skill set that I built for, you know, 30, 40 years that allowed us to evolve this far as a society is now no longer valuable. So
right.
we're all going to have that experience of creative destruction.
All of us.
All of us.
I mean, I'm waiting for it with, you know, comedy, and it's already, in a way, you know, I've experienced it very much so as an actor in this business,
mm-hmm.
and actors are about to experience it way more, because earning your living just as an actor, mm-hmm. wow, very difficult,
mm-hmm.
man. Even in TV nowadays, you're yep. not making that much money. They don't have to pay you that much. It's a lot more work in some ways, but if I didn't have live performance in my podcast, good luck, good luck.
Well, know? And I think that's the crucial thing is that people tend to assume, for example, that something like filmmaking has sort of been a static art. And that, you know, there's like no. this sort of constant demand. But the industry is constantly reinventing it.
Well, we are, as actors, we're competing with computer images.
Right.
We're competing with really great animation as well. We should, I suppose, because it's just another form of entertainment. But, yeah.
Yeah. So there's constant threats to everyone in every industry. There's not sub-industries.
And should be.
Yeah, and it should be. And some industries are more vulnerable than others. But the reality is that managing that creative destruction and creating a society that then is, rather than when people are, you know, their industries are creatively destroyed, that they become excluded from the society and become resentful and want to tear down the society, that they have the capacity to retool and repurpose and reintegrate, mm-hmm. right? And now bring that skill set that they had and fuse it with new skills. Because, you know, it's not that, you know, your old skills become irrelevant.
Mm.
Your old skills then cross-pollinate with the new skills to innovate and create something new and better than whatever existed before. All of these innovations, the printing press was originally a wine press, and that's what Gutenberg did. He took a wine press and combined it with movable type
really?
And a series of other things. Yeah.
Hmm.
So all of these innovations, they build off. That's why
off of, yeah.
other things.
They're standing on the shoulders of giants.
Or, as Henrik says, standing on the shoulders of hobbits.
Uh-huh.
And we're all standing on the shoulders of hobbits. We've all made our little contributions.
Sure.
And along the way, it builds into something remarkable.
Mm.
But we, you know, the designing a society and building a society that enables that process to be as effective as possible means that there has to be a lot of rethinking. You know, we still very much live in the shadow of the nation state. You know, the nation state, and, you know, I mean, for example, you know, people tend to think of these, you know, categories like
you're saying
German,
you know a lot, just so you know.
I know.
And thank
and
you to all of us
for calling
thank
me out.
Thank you to all of
yes.
our people for calling out Hunter on you
Hunter's
know.
Hunter's horrible verbal
You say
tech.
Okay and
yeah.
you know.
These are terrible
But you're getting a little
text.
Better, but I'm noticing you're falling back into it.
I calling. Know. It's because I'm trying to, you know, build
you know.
On a bunch of whole hobbits and, you know. Oh, Jesus. It's terrible. It's all falling apart. Okay, so... if you think about, we think, you know, in general, in terms of states, in terms of nations, Russian, American, but these identities are very, very modern. Italy as a country only dates back to 1871.
Right.
Germany as a country only dates back to 1871. Mm. And when they invented these nation states, they engaged in a whole bunch of folklore, and they looked back into a mythic past, and they invented these national categories. So the Dutch are very interesting because the Dutch looked back into all of the Roman sources, desperately trying to look for some sort of ancestral people that they could connect with. And then they found, oh, there are some references in a few sources to this tribe called the Batavians. And so they, out of nowhere, just because they didn't want to feel left out in the European context, decided, oh, yes, we are the descendants of the Batavians, about whom we know almost nothing about.
Yeah.
And they imagine this whole historical past. And periodically, you still see references to the Batavians. So one of the big bike companies in Holland is Batavus, right? And it's named after that. And Jakarta was originally called Batavia. In the Dutch period. And so there it's, but it's all this historical fantasy.
Right.
And we don't, in the modern age, we have the benefits of archaeology. Lots and lots of archaeology has happened. And so as we start to construct an identity based on our shared humanity, we don't have to reach into some sort of mythical past. We can look into the archaeological past. We can also look at neuroscience. We can look at psychology. We can look at all of these sorts of things. And we can construct an identity that is grounded in the reality of our shared human history, and that views this moment in history as a coming back together of the human tribe. That we all left Africa, we spread out around the world, we domesticated all those environments, we learned a bunch of things, we exchanged ideas along the way, and now we're coming together to create a global society in which everyone's contribution is valued and recognized. We want all the literatures, all the styles of music, all the different cuisines, we want to fuse them, we want to preserve them.
It's kind of already what's happening.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. It is a process that is already happening, and the point is that the only thing that we can change here is to clarify that process and to help people understand it more clearly and so that the transition happens more effortlessly and so that it happens with less violence and less pain and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it's a tough one though, because in any time you're dealing with not only the sharing of ideas, you're dealing with people coming into your space.
Mm-hmm.
And they have very different customs that they will not get rid of.
100%.
And you're also sharing resources that are becoming scarce. So there's a lot of, there are a lot of ifs to that.
And that is where, crucially, intelligence comes in. The wisdom to know the difference. Because your friend Noam, who runs the comedy club in New York.
Yeah, I don't know him, but I.
Sure. But the point is that he has the wisdom to know the difference.
Yeah.
He understands that what matters is that you serve my customers and that you perform that function. And what doesn't matter is that you wear a dress.
That's right.
And even though that you are chromosomally a man.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's irrelevant. And that is a lot of what this process is going to be about. It's going to be a process of sorting through what are the things that matter and what are the things that don't.
Hmm.
And the group of people who did that very well in terms of looking back on our shared historical past were the people who ran the caliphate, the caliphs, right? Because
the caliphate or the caliphate?
Well, the caliphate is drawing on the actual heritage of what the caliphate
of the 7th century.
That's
caliphate,
right.
Caliphate.
Because the caliphate.
Well, Baghdad was definitely a center of learning.
Hugely cosmopolitan.
Poetry.
The
in
greatest
fact, the,
library of
the,
its age.
The rivers, as the myth goes, ran not only red with blood, but black with ink, as those assholes from the steppes, those fucking dirty, moronic. You know what I fantasize about?
Yeah.
I've already probably said this. I want a helicopter gunship. I want the best one we have. I want a bunch of them. I want a fleet.
Yeah.
And when those Mongols are riding in 1250 or whatever it is, 1220, when they're riding toward Russia, when they're riding toward Baghdad when they're riding to. I want to fucking open up on those motherfuckers.
Like you have to like come over a hill, right? Like they're riding in.
That's
they're
exactly
about to,
right.
Yeah.
And the hellbirds, the giant wasps, rise up over the hill. And I would personally man those guns and I would shoot those motherfuckers. And not only that, I'd kill their horses too. And then I'd come in and I'd wipe out. I would create a wasteland and call it peace. I would take out all of. I would come in and Genghis Khan, Temujin, would be my favorite because I would hang that guy by his feet. I'd dress him up like a Mongol wench because he calls them wenches. And he would be my wench.
Yeah.
And I would make him dress up like a wench. And he'd have to sit in a chair tied up and just live his life as a wench.
Mm.
And I would make him do my laundry. I wouldn't kill him. He would have to do the things that he considered were women's work. It would be the greatest affront to his honor. As I laid his entire dead army in a pile at his feet, and that dead army, probably 50,000, 100,000 men, would be burned. And now, and I would grow a Fu Manchu, and I would have him hail me.
Oh, as the emperor? New
Genghis Khan. See what happened? I just became a mass murderer.
Yeah, exactly.
I just relished mass murder. And oh my God, in one impulse, I became Genghis Khan because I think I know what's right. But I do in that case. I have the hindsight. I have the hindsight of 50 history.
Let's test that, Brian.
Yeah.
So, do you know the story about the Chinese?
Well, by the way, because you know how sweet and kind not only the Ottoman Empire, but I'm sure the Baghdadis were back
then.
They
weren't.
Huh?
But Brian, let me ask you this. So, do you know the story of the Chinese man whose horse ran away? It's an old Chinese story.
No.
Okay, so Chinese man, his horse runs away, and all the villagers come to him, and they say, oh, that's so terrible, your horse ran away. And he goes, it's too soon to tell, we don't really know, is it terrible, is it not terrible? And then the next day, the horse comes back, but it's found a mare. And so now, he's not only got a horse, but he's got this free wild horse. And so the Chinese villagers come to him, and they say, oh my God, you're so lucky, this is so great, now you have two horses. And he goes, too soon to tell. Who can know? So then his son is out and he's training this wild horse and the horse throws him and his son breaks his leg and all the villagers come to him and they say, this is terrible. Your son has broken his leg. And, he goes, too soon to tell. Who can know? And the next day the army shows up and they conscript all the young men in the village except for his son who broke his leg and all the villagers. And you can do this story on and on until the end of time. Yeah. But I think it's very much the same thing with the Mongols.
It's a little bit like the Charlie Wilson's War, where Philip Seymour Hoffman would always say, we'll see.
Exactly.
We'll see. As in, there's always blowback.
And Jo Enn Lai's famous line?
Mm-mm.
So they asked Jo Enn Lai, what do you think?
Who is Jo Enn Lai?
Jo Enn Lai was a senior party official when Nixon was opening up China.
Okay.
So Jo Enn Lai, they asked Jo Enn Lai, what do you think of the French Revolution? And he goes, it's too soon to tell.
I could have finished that sentence.
Yeah.
That's great.
But so, a lot of the analysis of the Mongols is that they created this Pax Mongolica. And they did create temporarily this sort of huge ranging empire, which allowed for this massive movement of ideas, the reestablishment of a lot of these, trade routes and all of that stuff. And so if you stop the Mongol invasion with all of its awful bloodshed, you may end up destroying the Renaissance.
You're right. I hate to say it, and I thought about that. Not only that, you may certainly... Well, I mean, a lot of people credit Europe's ability to surpass the Middle East, because of the Mongols. The sacking of Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, the Arab world's never come back from that. Or it certainly has been hard to do so. Europe had a chance to catch up and surpassed technologically and militarily and all that stuff. And
I think there are other reasons
of course.
And I think it,
you don't want to go back and start tinkering with history. It is what it is. It would have worked its way out. And if you try to stop injustices with violence, And there is a place for that. I mean, we did that with fascism and slavery and things, but you better be very careful.
But the
we
the
tried
crucial,
to do that in Baghdad after all.
And but the crucial thing is that it's understanding what is the function and the role of a dictator. And a dictator establishes he's the Leviathan. He's Hobbes's Leviathan. Mm. He's a monster who's so terrible. And so the word for, you know, Ivan the Terrible, mm-hmm. obviously. Mm-hmm. So the actual word in Russian is Grozny. So Ivan Grozny. And in fact, the word Grozny, though, doesn't mean what Americans tend to think it means. It doesn't mean like a bad dude necessarily. What it means is it means a guy who makes his enemies fear him and keeps the people in obedience.
Yeah.
And that is what a dictator does.
Putin.
Putin. Yeah. In a nutshell.
Strong man.
Strong man.
Will keep you safe as long as you give him all your money.
The Godfather.
And all your power.
He's the Godfather. It's a protection racket. It's a massive protection racket. But the Arabs have this old saying that it's better to live, you know, 60 years in tyranny than one day in anarchy. And anarchy, anarchy is a terrible, terrible thing. The war of all against all, as Hobbes called it.
Well, just it breaks up into gangs.
Exactly.
And, you know, you have, that's exactly what goes on anytime you have vigilante justice and a breakdown of the institutions of the courts and police and due process. You're going to have extrajudicial killings based on a hunch, based on settling scores. You know, conflict resolution, Jared Diamond talks about being, is a huge part of how you form, or a huge factor in forming a successful society. Conflict 100%. Resolution is huge.
Mm-hmm.
We are so, in many ways, the most important book I've ever read was The Wealth of Nations. I'm sorry, Why Nations Fail.
Yeah.
Darren Acemoglu and his buddy.
James Robinson.
Yeah, I have to say that book is so important to read because it makes me realize how lucky we are that we have these impeccable institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are, and corruption is must be treated with, you know, great severity. I mean,
100%.
Yeah.
And that is the challenge of the moment that we find ourselves in. So I've been reading all these books about Putin and Putin's Russia. And right now I'm reading Garry Kasparov, the former world chess champion's book, Winter's Coming, which is excellent. And
really?
It's worth a read, and I intend to get him on the
Travels
podcast.
Travels Russia, really?
Oh, yeah. I want to get Kasparov on so badly. But Brian,
Travels Russia with his own water and food.
Yeah, because otherwise, and he doesn't fly Aeroflot, because Putin has poisoned people, dissidents on Aeroflot before.
I'm sure he has.
I think Anna Politkovskaya, who was a Russian journalist.
And they shot her in the head when it didn't work.
Yeah, they shot her in an elevator in our apartment building.
Yeah, good. Thanks, dude.
Yeah. So
he's so short-sighted.
Putin?
Yeah, people love to talk about how smart he is. He's not smart. He's just brutal.
He's a thug. Yeah.
Yeah.
But he has fooled the West. I mean, that's Kasparov's point. Is just that he fooled the West for a long time in the sense that Putin was able to make it seem like he was a legitimate leader. He showed up at all these meetings. He had elections. All of that sort of stuff. And the United States and the West were more interested in having some sort of, you know, diplomatic relations and some sort of open channel of communication. And so
what would you do, though? What would you do
in terms of Putin's massive kleptocracy?
Now.
Yeah.
How would you deal with it?
I think that what our good buddy who Thomas Piketty has identified.
I've not read his book.
Okay. I don't Piketty's book is one of those books where you read it and it has one idea that he endlessly proves, and there are some interesting things in there. But the central point that he makes is that I think is the most valuable is that you can't have an effective taxation system if you have these financial bolt holes. So as long as I can go and stash my money in a place like Singapore or the Cayman Islands or anything like that, then taxation of the wealthy becomes essentially irrelevant. Because they have the ability to hide their wealth wherever they want. And this is the basic problem of Russia, because Russia, you know, you have Putin and you have all of his buddies and all of the oligarchs, and they rip off the Russian people. All of their wealth is extractive and based on natural resources, gas, oil, and all that sort of stuff. And then they go and live in places like London because it has rule of law and it has security and it has all of that. And they stash their money overseas as well. So you're now in a situation where, whether we like it or not, we live in a global society. And the concept of the nation state has always, of course, had problems because there were always international incidents, but we had things to handle that, like extradition and all of that stuff. Now we fundamentally need to
boycott as a responsible nation should start to probably say to these oligarchs, you can't keep your money here.
You can't keep your money here. That's the first thing.
You can't own apartments here.
You can't own apartments here. And that's why they have the Magnitsky Act, and they are starting to do that.
Really? But also, is the Magnitsky
Act? So Bill Browder, who was had the Hermitage Fund. He was an American, and he had this big fund for investing in Russia.
Because George Clooney's doing this also with somebody else, with the Darfur, with the people in power at Darfur.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a huge issue. But Bill Browder was this, wrote a book called Red Notice, which is very good. It's all about being in Russia. He went to Russia when it was the Wild East, made a bunch of money, and Magnitsky was his lawyer, who didn't flee the country and was murdered, essentially. He was taken into custody, and then things happened in custody that led to him dying. Yeah. He was denied medical care and all these sorts of things. And Putin was like, people die in custody in American jails too, so what?
Mm-hmm. Surprise.
They just don't happen to be political dissidents, as a rule. So, but this is a big issue, and Blood Oil also deals with it very well, in the sense that we object to, you know, these terrible leaders in places like, you know, anywhere, you know, Darfur, Africa, Darfur, Sudan, and all that sort of stuff. But then we let them sell those resources on the world market.
That's right.
And so,
which is immoral. I agree with you.
And the proposal that the author of Blood Oil makes is that that a leader has to demonstrate popular sovereignty and support for it before they're able to sell their resources on the world market.
100%. You could get forensic accountants and things like that to put so much pressure on these people. Why in the world these Russian oligarchs and Putin and all these people have all their money in Russian apartments and, I mean, I'm sorry, in British and probably American property and their banks and in Swiss banks? I do think it's immoral.
Mm-hmm.
I do. I think it's, I think that is exactly where you'd hit them, in where it counts.
You hit them in the pocketbook because that's what they're doing.
With Iranians.
Putin is estimated to be the richest man in the world.
Yeah.
$200 billion.
Where's that money?
It's scattered all over the place in places like Switzerland and, you know, hidden. There's a whole bunch of Gazprom shares that are just sort of missing. Nobody knows where they are. It's pretty clear that they're Putin's.
Sure.
And the dividends on those shares are $170 or $80 million a year, something like that.
Yeah.
You got to hit all of these people in the pocketbook.
I agree.
And that's how you bring them into line, because the whole point is...
I agree 100%. They're not going to listen to anything else. They kill people.
Of course.
You've got these guys who settle differences with murder.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I did. There's no other way to fight them.
It's the thing that they care about. And if that incentive scheme is gone, if you can't steal and then hide your money, because of their,
and just the atrocities,
of
like
course,
that the Sudanese, like the president of South Sudan and those people, like George Clooney was talking about that. Hit them in the pocketbook. They're taking resources. They're taking, it's a very wealthy country, Sudan, actually, a lot of resources,
mm-hmm.
and they just take it and put it in foreign bank accounts.
Do you know
Do
you know the old joke about the African guy and the Asian guy who go to the London School of Economics?
No.
So so there's an African guy and an Asian guy, right? And they go to London School of Economics together, right? They have a great time. They're in London, you know, they're in their 20s, whatever, whatever, whatever. And so then afterwards, with this great education from the London School of Economics, they're going to go back and they're going to run their countries. And they both do. They don't see each other for 30 years. And then they reconnect one day at a reunion, right? And they say, oh, it's so good to see you. You know, I would love to come see your home. We should get together and all of that sort of stuff. So the African guy goes to visit the Asian guy, and he arrives at this airport, and it's this gleaming, very nice airport. And then he gets in the car, and it's a really nice car. And then he drives through, oh, there are all these skyscrapers. You know, it's just a fantastic place. And he pulls up to the guy's house, and it's amazing. It's this palatial palace. It's a great swimming pool. Everything is the best. And the African guy says to the Asian guy, this is amazing. Look at your house. Look at your car. How did you do this? And he goes, very simple. 10%. And then the Asian guy flies to Africa and he lands in a decrepit, shitty airport. He gets in a very nice car, drives through these slums. People are starving. There's disease. It's terrible. And then he pulls up to the guy's house, and it's an amazing house with this great swimming pool and all these fancy cars. And the Asian guy says to the African guy, how did you do this? And he says, very simple, 90%.
It's fucking great. It's great and so god dang true.
But that is the real tension that we're all facing, is that we all want to do well, but there's a huge difference between taking 10% and taking 90%.
Now, you've got to make I think, leaders of those countries dependent on their populace, on the prosperity of their populace, on the prosperity, on the productivity of their populace. And you can't do that without ensuring property rights, having a system of the courts, a court system that honors contracts, that honors the breach of contracts. You've got to have objective law.
Do you know what the conviction rate is in Russia?
It's probably so ridiculous.
99%.
Oh, it is.
99% of people who are put on trial are convicted.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So... and they have one of the things that Kasparov talks about is telephone justice, where the judge disappears not to deliberate, but to go call somebody up the power ladder and say, how do I decide this? And then they come back. But it's also important to recognize that people like Putin are parasitizing Western rule of law.
Yeah.
Because they are taking advantage of stable banks, stable courts, rule of law, all of that sort of stuff. And so they're stealing in one place, and then they're hiding and securing in another place.
Of course, they're taking advantage of the fact that our country has all these guarantees.
100%.
And they're protecting their money.
And you shouldn't be allowed to do that.
I agree.
And so
this act is called a what? You have
There's the Magnitsky Act.
The Magnitsky Act.
Which was one of the things that Bill Browder helped push through. And so they're trying to essentially get it so these oligarchs can't take their money out of the country and they can't just hide it wherever they want. And then also there's the great book Blood Oil. But I think that this is a core initiative of the sort of thing that the Caliphate, which is a loosely organized tribe that exists all over the world, that we can push for. We should be spreading the word and spreading awareness and dropping knowledge bombs about these sorts of ideas and basically be saying that you don't get to take your money out of the country if your country is run in such a way that you are violating human rights and you are stealing from the people.
Yeah, makes sense.
It's a pretty basic idea.
I like that idea, my friend. In closing, Hunter, give us an idea of how you organize your mind one more time.
Well, that's the key thing, is it's organizing it. You're always trying to, so if you've read The Straight A Conspiracy,
yes.
The key chapter on there in memory is to navigate your test prep like a London cabbie. And the London cabbies have this amazing memory. And, you know, London is not like New York. No. You go to New York, it's this amazing grid system. Yes. And, you know, 59th Street,
London is 60th
Street.
It takes them 2 years, it's called the knowledge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Four years.
Yeah.
But you know, London has evolved sort of chaotically with all these cart paths, and they all have weird Harry Potterish British names like Throgmorton Street and all of that stuff. But what the cabbies do, and this is what I do, is the key thing is that you look for routes. So you're looking for what are the main routes through London. Mm. And then once you have that sort of the major routes, then you can build the side streets off of them.
Mm.
So in my mind, and what I'm constantly looking for and trying to develop, are these core routes. What are the key thematic threads that are happening throughout history, human affairs, people's thinking, and all of that sort of stuff. And when you understand those things, then you can hang the facts off. So you can have little facts like Magnitsky, which is easy to remember because it sounds like magnet.
But as long as you have the main roots, which is the idea that, you know, probably when it comes to social policy or politics, politics, we kind of, we know, you know how to articulate why the scientific method, property rights, courts with integrity and all
but
that.
But a lot of these things are not necessarily things. This is, you read, you know, people people ask me about books, and the reality is that you read most books, and there may be, a lot of them are crap.
Yeah.
They're just a crap book.
Or they should be way shorter.
Way shorter. Or they're massive. Yeah, they're massively redundant. Or
Brian Johnson, by the way. Did you turn me on to John?
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, our boy Abdel Bayoud, who I love. Oh, yeah. I always talk to. Abdel Bayoud is the best. He's, that guy is, I think he's from Algeria.
Yeah, he's always the Algerian turning me on. Michael Malice.
He's the best. He's always turning me on to different stuff. He's just, I love him because he's all, I've never met him, but I can't wait to meet him someday. But he's always turning me on to, and this guy, Brian Johnson, reads books and breaks them down for you. Can get a lot done that way. But, anyway.
but the key thing is that periodically you find those things, and you're always testing your narratives to see what is good at making sense of a lot of things. So, for example, we talked about there's this basic progression in societies from tribes of 150 to these sort of large states of where they have monopoly on legitimate violence, and then you can lump a whole bunch of people into a fairly effective category. The pharaoh is not that different from the Chinese emperor, is not that different from the king, is not that different from Vladimir Putin. It's sort of that first...
And also the way governments have always controlled people and the price that those people pay, their countries ultimately pay.
Mm-hmm.
Why the founding fathers are right and always right. Why the Constitution is the great idea in philosophy, political philosophy at least, yeah.
And so, you know, the Leviathan, that's sort of that next stage, Hobbes. And you start to realize very often, I mean, human nature, you find that it's not that complicated. And very often there are 1,000 names for what's more or less the same concept. And then that second stage is where you start to have rule of law. Which is what they talk about so powerfully in Why Nations Fail, and that is the forgotten stage. That's the stage that people don't realize. Before you could have the American Revolution, you had to have the Glorious Revolution of 1666, where the law was put above the king. And any time, and the problem is Americans don't recognize that, and the way that history is taught and the way that people think of American history is that we lived under this terrible dictatorship of King George III, and then overnight
we borrowed
freedom.
Much from the British.
Yeah, and also the constant rhetoric in the Seven Years' War, which was the war before the American Revolution, was how grateful we were to live under an English king rather than a French king.
A French king, that's right.
Because the French king was an absolutist monarch.
But don't we also owe much to the Napoleonic laws, to the French Revolution?
No, not really, because that came afterwards, and we have a common law rather than...
Right, the French Revolution came in the
1789,
I'm sorry, yeah.
So the American Revolution, 1776, French Revolution, 1789, but the question that Fukuyama always asks, which is the key question, is why did the American Revolution succeed, and why did the French Revolution descend into chaos and terror. And the reason why is because they didn't have rule of law. They had this absolutist monarch. And so when you remove the Leviathan and you don't have rule of law, then you slide back down into anarchy and the war of all against all.
Yeah, a warlord comes about because he's good
at
organizing a bunch of murderers.
And that's what Napoleon was.
Yeah.
He was a warlord, but he was also a warlord who began the process of transitioning France into rule of law. So you get the reorganization of the legal code with the Napoleonic code. He has to be more responsive to the people. And then you have a series, you know, the Bourbons come back and so on and so forth. But over a period of time, France gets to rule of law, which
it
is why...
It fits and starts. And then
that's
right.
But ultimately, they figure out rule of law, and that's why ultimately they're ready for a democratic civil society. But the Arab Spring, you tried to progress again. It's the terror, the French terror that happens after the French Revolution, and the Arab Spring, it's equivalent events. They both tried to progress directly from dictatorship to democracy.
Very tough.
And it failed because you need rule of law first.
You
first need the belief that we go and we resolve our differences through the courts rather than in the streets by trying to chop each other's heads
Almost
off.
Every revolution descends into civil war.
Because most revolutions don't start from rule of law.
Mm.
Rule of law is the really scarce thing.
It is.
Most of the world doesn't have... What is Russia missing?
Well,
Russia's
I think that the American Revolution, the founding fathers, didn't lose sight of what they were fighting for. In the election between Jefferson and Madison, or was it Hamilton? I think it was Madison. Hamilton, I can't remember anyway, but in that election, it could have easily broken into two camps that were very much at odds with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that we're very lucky we didn't break into a civil war then. But
anyway. And that, you know, they listened to the better angels of their nature, but they had also inherited a culture that had a sense of shared norms, which allowed their society to work, and which believed fundamentally in rule of law and courts
and
justice
and ideas.
And books and ideas.
Yeah.
As one of my favorite quotes, the David McCulloch quote from 1776, yep. They lived in a time when it was believed that a man by serious and diligent application to books could teach himself whatever was required.
And that is Hunter's Manifesto, and it should be yours, you bastards. And add to that YouTube. You can learn a lot on fucking YouTube.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, once again, an hour that changes your mind, or at least infects it with the good ideas, where ideas have sex. This has been Brian Callen and Hunter Mons. Good night and good luck.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.